It's great to be here with you, and looks like you're having a great conference, and I'm honored to be part of this. In his introduction, Josh mentioned the two books that I've written on the universities and on Christian scholarship. One is called The Soul of the American University, which is more historical work, and the other is The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship, which I see there's a few sitting on by the window there. These two books grew out of my own experience, as most books do in one way or another. I taught at Calvin College in Grand Rapids, Michigan for 20 years. And then toward the end of that time, I spent the first of two terms as a visiting professor at the University of California, Berkeley. And the first time I was there in 1986, I got very interested in the history of universities. Up to that time, I had done mainly the history of my own Protestant, Reformed, et cetera, religious tradition. I got interested in the history of universities, particularly because I had been at Calvin College, where there was an extraordinarily sophisticated discussion going on among many people in the faculty in all sorts of disciplines, including mathematics, I might say, about what it meant to be a Christian scholar, and lots of people were doing it very well. There were people there like Al Planninga, Nicholas Waldersdorf, and they're probably the two best known, but many others involved in that conversation. It was really an impressive sort of scholarship that they were doing. But at the University of California at Berkeley, that sort of thing was virtually unknown. I suppose it was known in the philosophy department, but in most of this mega university, huge university, the very idea of doing Christian scholarship or scholarship from a Christian perspective would have seemed simply a strange sort of idea. And it was all the stranger, it seemed to me, when I looked into the history of Berkeley and realized that the University of California was originally a little Presbyterian college that in the 1860s, just after the Civil War, this Presbyterian college ceded itself to the state and became the basis for the state university, keeping the Presbyterian faculty for a state university. So not so long ago, even a state university had been a Presbyterian school, and relating Christianity to what people were doing would have been a normal sort of thing. So I got very interested in how we got as a culture from that starting point to the finishing point. That was the experience that shaped my work on universities and Christian scholarship. The premise that I have worked from is one that I think relates to a peculiarity in American culture, and that is a very large percentage of Americans claim to believe in God, and even if you recognize that for many of them that's a fairly low voltage kind of belief, even so, there's probably 30% or so who are quite serious religious believers, mostly by far Christian believers. Yet, in our educational system, people don't assume that religious belief will necessarily relate to their education. They might go to their state university and think nothing of it, to have 4 years of education in which there's no real thought going on about what the relationship between their faith and what they're learning out here in the secular culture. And that seems to me to be a strange state of affairs. I mean, if people believe in a being who is great enough to create and sustain this universe, which is larger than we can really imagine, who at the same time is interested in our personal prayers, and we believe that there's it makes sense to pray, and that God is hearing these prayers and responding to them. Those are immense sorts of claims, and you would think that everyone who made those claims would automatically say, this is going to relate to everything else that I think about, what I think about politics, what I think about economics, what I think about marriage, what I think about personal relationships, what I think about poverty, what I think about war, justice, etc. But a lot of Americans who have the religious belief don't really carry it through as far as what they think about in other aspects of life, and they seem content to learn a great deal of what they learn as though God did not exist. So that's the premise. That's a sort of the puzzle. Why is that that people do that? Now, what you're talking about in both cases, the case of universities have become secular, and second, people generally accept that as a normal state of affairs, is what we talk about as a privatization of religious belief. It's okay to have religious belief in this country. It's even maybe a good thing, and you can even express it in public. But when you do, it's expected to be in pretty superficial ways. So if you get the hit in the World Series, you can point to heaven and thank God for that. But it's not that's really not intersecting with the public domain in any substantial way. Universities are defined as part of the public domain, and a religion is defined as essentially a private matter. And so it's come to be accepted that you keep your private beliefs to yourselves in this public domain. Now, there's some good reasons why the culture has developed the privatization of religious belief. If you go back to the time when the College of California, its Presbyterian school, became the University of California, and was run by Presbyterians, well, there's something wrong with that, because what about people who aren't Presbyterians? What about Methodists or more to the point, what about Catholics or Jews or people of Muslims, the people of other religious faiths? Where is their university? So it makes some sense to get rid of a Protestant establishment in public institutions. And what was going on in the late 19th century was that the United States was consolidating it was going through a process of modernization and national consolidation. The Civil War was a big boost in that, and industrialization is part of building a modern nation state. And as that consolidation is going about, there's a lot of pressure in the culture to make things more uniform. And religious belief is something, particularly in the United States, there's a lot of it, but it's not very uniform. And the public domain will run better if you just get that out of the public domain. It can get in the way. And so the new universities were defined in a way that tended to push religion to the private domain. The universities were defined under the rubric of freedom was the great ideal, teaching people to be free democratic citizens, and most relevant to this discussion, emphasizing that the core of the university is research that's based on academic freedom of free scientific inquiry. And what is free scientific inquiry? Well, it's unbiased scientific inquiry with biases such as religious bias kept out of the picture. As I said, there's a good bit to be said for what was going on. It becomes a way of assimilating diverse peoples into the American nation and bringing them in on an equal basis. And there are legitimate concerns for equity that are going on. For instance, I think it would be improper for a professor at a state university to open classes with Christian prayers and sort of make it a statement that by doing so that being Christian is a normal state of affairs. That state university has concerns for equity that make that problematic. At the same time, what I say and what is the point of this is that these good arrangements, which have lots of good reasons for them, I think also involve an overcorrection. And that's really what we're dealing with. We're not dealing with just sort of bad secular things versus good Christian things, but rather we're dealing with some secular arrangements that make a lot of sense, but have been carried too far because of the sense they make. People carry them further than they ought to be carried. And particularly, they're overcorrected when they get to the point of saying that it's inappropriate to have religious perspectives in mainstream universities. And my argument, developed particularly in The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship, is simply that if there's room for feminist perspectives and Marxist perspectives and neoconservative perspectives and African-American perspectives and gay perspectives and liberal democratic perspectives and conservative Republican perspectives, et cetera, why should there not be various forms of Christian perspectives, which are many, Jewish perspectives, Islamic perspectives, Buddhist perspectives, and the like? Why, if scholars from those backgrounds are willing to take into account the legitimate concerns for equity and pluralism and the like, shouldn't they be working from explicitly, or as is very nicely put here, intentionally Christian perspectives or other religious perspectives? There are legitimate objections to that proposal too, that proposal can be made in too strong a way. I mean, it seems to me it doesn't really advance the cause a great deal if someone simply tries to preempt a scholarly discussion by quoting scripture, whatever the scripture might be, and say, this ends the matter because scripture tells us such and so. That may be something that among ourselves we might discuss, but in a public forum, that doesn't really do much good, because you're appealing to authority that not everyone accepts. It's like in a court of law, if you use a special revelation as your primary evidence, other people are just going to be left cold by it. And that's a valid concern as far as it goes. That you can't, in a pluralistic setting, simply argue from the basis of authority. I have this authority, because then you get into real standoff. Somebody has another scripture, another revelation as their private authority, as their trump card. But that being granted, there's another kind of scholarship that ought to be legitimate. And that is scholarship in which the background of one's scholarship is deeply shaped by religious commitment. The religious commitment is like what people talk about in social location. It's for deeply religious people, it's a very important social location that is going to have an impact on the way they think about things. So, for instance, you might have a Mennonite who's saying that warfare is wrong, or Dorothy Day, who is emphasizing Jesus' concern for the poor, or other Christians might emphasize that that human nature is naturally corrupt and be suspicious of utopian hopes. Still others might believe that there is ground for great hope for human improvement because of particular religious beliefs that they have. But any of that kind of viewpoint can be argued for in the academy. It may grow out of one's belief in special revelation, but the arguments that one would give for it would be arguments that are publicly accessible, that concerns that are widely that are widely held. Despite the fact that one might not necessarily even be articulating the source of one's religious belief, the religious belief comes to be a controlling factor in the kind of scholarship and that one's doing and the kind of conclusions that one is coming to. Nicholas Waldersdorf talks about this as control beliefs, that such beliefs, even if not directly expressed, act as significant control on other things that we do. So you can do the technical scholarship within the frameworks of your basic religious beliefs. Now, if people are deeply religious, that's going to happen to some extent anyway. I said at the beginning, people don't think a whole lot about this often. But even when they don't think much about it, it tends to happen because, for instance, much of scholarship in the humanities, the social sciences, and the like has a strong evaluative moral dimension, and people's religious beliefs will almost inevitably have a real impact on that dimension of what they're doing. But then you might say, well, then what's all the fuss about? If this is going to happen pretty much anyway, it's sort of in the background of people's beliefs, their control beliefs, what's all the fuss about? And I think it's basically, the question comes down to, how hard are you going to think about this relationship between your religious belief and what else you're doing? Is it something that you're going to generally take the attitude toward that this is to be suppressed, that this is illegitimate to some extent, which is the general attitude that's pushed in university culture for the reasons I alluded to? It's deeply ingrained in university culture that this is just a bit unprofessional to relate your religious belief to what else you're doing. Or you can take the attitude, my religious belief is the most important set of beliefs I have, and I ought to be thinking really hard about how it relates to what else I'm thinking about. That this should be one of the major enterprises that I engage in, which I gather probably most people in this room are here because they have some interest in doing that. This is, I think, an important way of sort of explaining what the fuss is about, why this makes a difference. It is going to happen anyway, because religious beliefs shape what's your social location, your intellectual location, whatever you want to call it. But why shouldn't you think hard about it? And it seems to me there are a number of ways in which, if you think about it, you'll recognize how religious belief is shaping academic work. First of all, the very broad question, what do I think is important enough to study? And that sometimes if you're dealing, if Josh said his field is mathematics, which is one of the tough ones to come up with some good examples of how it works. But at least, why should I be studying this? Why should I spend my life doing this rather than that? What's the reason I'm doing this? How does this fit as a Christian vocation? And that certainly applies to any discipline. Second, what kinds of questions do you ask about your subject? And here, the examples that are easiest to come up with are ones that are in the human disciplines, human sciences, social sciences, history, English, literature, and the like. What are the important questions? If I'm talking about history, should it be working on attitudes toward the poor? Should it be working on how people get rich, et cetera, or in economics? What's the bottom line that I'm working on? Third, what are the currently fashionable interpretive strategies that are compatible with my religious belief? We are all in university situations where there's all sorts of popular interpretive strategies around. Which ones fit with my particular set of religious beliefs, and which ones should I be very critical of because of my religious beliefs? Sometimes people don't think nearly enough about that. And finally, how do I evaluate things? So in the sciences and arts that deal with humans, there's a great deal of moral evaluation that goes on in the university. What should be the basis for that, and how do my religious beliefs intersect with that? So clearly, a number of very important ways in which religious belief does intersect with other things you're thinking about. It's going to show up more, of course, in the humanities and the social sciences than in the hard sciences. And the more technical one's discipline, probably the less some of those questions will make a real difference, or the more technical aspects of your discipline. There are technical aspects of a discipline in which religious belief isn't going to make a whole lot of difference. If I'm determining the date that Washington crossed the Delaware, I do that pretty much the same way that any other historian might. But my evaluative framework for thinking about Washington crossed the, who do I talk about? Do I talk about Washington? Do I celebrate him as the great father of the country, or do I think about the soldiers and what's happening to them, et cetera? I mean, there's all sorts of things that would be impacted by my religious beliefs, but there's technical dimensions that would not be. One of the reasons I think, in talking about this for the last 15 years, that I see quite a bit, is that people find this difficult actually to do, is that there's often a disjunction between the level of their expertise in their academic discipline and the level of their expertise in their Christian tradition. I talk often at church-related colleges, and even there you get faculty members who have a PhD in their discipline and have a sort of Sunday school training in their religious heritage. And they think, how am I going to put these two things together? They have all this, 5 or 6 years of graduate school in the discipline and just a passing knowledge of Christianity. Well, no wonder they can't put the two things together. And the same for at each level, the undergraduate level. You spend many hours working on a particular subject and discipline in your major. How many hours are you working on the Christian tradition that you're coming from. It's thinking about this, I think it's also important to recognize that your religious faith isn't going to change everything in your scholarship. It's not always a dramatic sort of thing. We are shaped not only by our religious commitments, but we're shaped by a lot of other things. So I, for instance, am a Reformed Christian, and I'm a white male American. I've been influenced by American political traditions, views of science in the modern world, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole bunch of things that shaped my scholarship, and I'm also trained in the craft of doing history. Religious faith is one of the major components, but there's a bunch of other major components. And often, in my experience, I see that it's very important how you just do the craft of your discipline. If you do that really well, people will listen to what else you have, what else you have to say. That really is important. If you're going to be a Christian witness in the university world, you have to do you have to do your homework really well. You have to be a master of the craft. And if you are, then people will listen. If you're just superficial, they'll have an excuse to dismiss what you're doing. A couple other cautions or words of advice that, in thinking about this, and then I want to get to some time for questions. One is that over the years in talking about this, I've come to realize that the term Christian scholarship is problematic for a lot of people. It's a good shorthand among ourselves to talk about what we're doing, but it can cause real problems with a lot of other people. And I was impressed a few years ago. I was on a panel about this subject, and there was an Orthodox Jewish scholar on the panel. He was very sympathetic with basically all the things I've said so far, except the idea of Christian scholarship. He just said, it's really, if you're Jewish, it's almost impossible to get around that as not being an imperialistic kind of thing. And I think we need to be sensitive to that. The Christians have run things generally for a long time, and other people are very suspicious of a kind of imperialism that they see. Another problem with the term Christian scholarship is that what we might, when we say Christian, we're thinking of St. Augustine or Thomas Aquinas or John Calvin or Jonathan Edwards or some profound thinkers in the Christian tradition. The people who hear us are thinking fundamentalism. Here's the religious right on the university campus. These are the followers of Bob Jones and Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson and the like, and they're very quick to dismiss it because almost the only people who use Christian as an adjective in this way today are people on the religious right. So it translates into people's mind as fundamentalist scholarship. I think it's important to look for terminological alternatives. I like the term used in this conference, the intentionally Christian scholarship. I think that at least gets at the crucial issue. I mean, you can explain to people, as I just have, well, it's going to happen anyway. Is it going to be intentional or is it going to be haphazard? But even beyond that, I think although Christian may be a good shorthand among ourselves, it's also confusing among ourselves because among ourselves there are many different things that we mean. I teach at a Catholic university, and I'm a Protestant. Catholic scholarship is a different thing than Protestant scholarship, and there are 11 different, 100 different types of Catholic scholarship as well, and of course there are even more probably different types of Protestant scholarship. So it's helpful to identify particular traditions that you're working in. Augustinian is a term I often use. People talk about Thomist or Presbyterian, Reformed, Lutheran, Anabaptist, Baptist, Methodist, Evangelical, Niebuhrian. Those particulars, I think, if you use those particulars, it helps clarify to people that you're coming from a substantial intellectual tradition and you're not just an anti-intellectual Christian fundamentalist who's sort of trying to get a hearing in the university but isn't looking at anything very substantial. So I think it's helpful to identify the particular tradition that you're working in and then to work really hard in knowing about that tradition and in learning about the resources of that tradition. Another thing I've learned over the years, I think the personal dimension is immensely important. I was at a conference last week in the West Coast in which the emphasis was engaging the mainstream culture. And the emphasis there was one I think is terribly important, that to do it well, you have to engage people and take them seriously. That being confrontational often alienates more people than it helps. And I've seen that in my own experience, that sometimes I've been, I think, more confrontational than I needed to be. And the reason The Outrageous Idea of Christian Scholarship has that title is because when I first started talking about this, I got some really strong reactions from people who just said, this is outrageous, and what are you talking about? That, it isn't like gender, or it isn't like race. It's a completely different sort of thing. And so I had to try to very calmly say it's not all that outrageous. But I think you have to be careful not to alienate your audience. But I think the best way to put this is that what is needed is a consciousness raising among you and your friends and as much as possible about the importance of thinking about these relationships. 45 years ago, gender made a great deal of difference in the way people thought about things, but there weren't very many people thinking hard about what difference gender made in the way they thought about things. Then there's been a generation of people who have thought hard about that, and there is great academic enrichment. Sometimes there's excesses, sometimes there's alienation and so forth, but overall there's great academic enrichment coming from that. And I think the same should happen, can happen, I think is happening in faith-related kinds of scholarship, many religious traditions have substantial intellectual heritages that can be developed and related to what else they're studying, what else they're thinking about. And as I said at the beginning, if you really do believe that there is a God immense enough to create and sustain this universe and who is personally interested in you, that's such an immense claim that it ought to be making a difference in everything else you're thinking about. And so it gives you an agenda of things that you should be spending a lifetime really thinking hard about. Thank you, and I'll be glad to... I'll be glad to take some questions.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for your talk. You justify the the place of Christian scholarship in the academy on the value of pluralism. And if you were to look, if you look at the American Academy today and you ask, where is it that you can study Jewish thought? Where is it that you can study Islamic thought? Where is it that you can take classes on Averroes, Maimonides, Avicenna? I think you'll find that there's two places. There's here at the University of Chicago, in places like the Committee on Social Thought and the Political Science Department. And then there's Catholic universities. You can study this type of thing. And what they have in common, University of Chicago and Catholic universities, is they put forward metaphysical questions as being very important for undergraduates to wrestle with. And you write in one of your articles that, you write that today's student travels light, unburdened with the baggage of metaphysical questions. And I would have thought from that that you would have placed, you would have justified the role of, the place that Christian scholarship should have in the academy on the importance of answering, you know, these metaphysical questions, is, and that Christian thought, like Islamic thought, like Jewish thought, is content, is knowledge that addresses these metaphysical questions rather than on the value of pluralism.
Well, I don't think it's an either or, but I there's nothing that you said that I disagree with. I mean, I think that's another line of argument, and in other occasions I have attempted that line of argument. I mean, simplest is, you know, when for a long time people thought that universities should be a center for truth seeking, and today, truth is something that universities tend to put in the scare quotes. And if you're seeking the truth, well, then does it make any sense to close off huge possibilities for what the truth of things might be? So, but anyway, I think that's well taken, and that's another argument. I guess I'm trying to think of my emphasis on the pluralism is as a strategic thing, as a way of explaining to the, you know, larger audience why this makes sense, why it should be out of place, why this is an overcorrection, because it's sort of the instinct of a lot of people to say, well, you know, we have separation of church and state, and even, I mean, you know, that takes care of most of the universities in the countries, and the others are essentially serving the whole community and should be obeying the same rules.
Yeah. The University of Chicago has a reputation, and I think deservedly so, of really listening to all sorts of ideas. I know that in my field of Christian education, I have been received, you know, they thought it was outrageous, but they were my professors, not so much students, were willing to engage me, and I was very, very grateful for that. My question is, there are some academic environments that are not so gracious, not so liberal with a big L, in which there really is a reigning orthodoxy, and if you come against that, then the antithesis is very much in play. And whereas I agree with you totally that we shouldn't be confrontational, but I'm asking what should we do when the other people are being confrontational? Because it's I think that's a huge issue in the academy, especially for undergraduates. I'm a graduate student, but for undergraduates who are learning to speak about faith, it
can
be very intimidating.
Yes, well, that's a good observation. And in my own experience, I got into this when I was teaching at Duke University, and this was in the late 80s and the early 90s. And there were at least segments of that university that were very hostile to this kind of thing, particularly the religion department. You get people who went to university and either lost their faith or drastically changed it, and then they see their mission in life as to get other people to do the same thing. And anyway, that's being in that situation, I think, is one of the reasons that I found myself being more controversial than I would like to be. And I remember giving a talk, sort of along this line, there and to the religion department, and someone who knew better got up and said afterward, "Well, he said, what if you? I talked about Calvin College, and I taught there, and what a great place it was, and so forth." And he said, "Well, suppose someone was trying to, develop a college or that had a faculty of these religious believers. Where would they find them? Or people like that don't have PhDs." It's basically saying, these fundamentalists, don't really do scholarship, and they could never really participate. Well, as I say, this person knew better, but it was, or when I was going to Notre Dame, people saying, you're going to be in an atmosphere where there won't be academic freedom because Catholic teachings are around. So. There are those sorts of things that you run into occasionally, but I'm convinced of this, that 90% of the time, if you're doing your job well and you're being you're paying attention to the people that are around you and not being personally modeling what a Christian scholar should be. People will respect what you do. Not always, but I think that goes a long way. And there's all sorts of instances that you can point out of people being quite explicitly Christian in places where you think it would be difficult to do, and it can be accepted if it's done right. Yeah.
If I understood what you were saying correctly, it seems like you're saying that one should start with one's faith and then apply that to scholarship. And there have been others at this conference, without misrepresenting them, I believe, who said, if you start with your discipline and then ask questions about truth as it relates to that discipline, you will arrive at Christian truth. And I'm wondering if you could discuss the discrepancy in those approaches.
I hope it's not a discrepancy. I tend to think in a more Augustinian tradition that faith precedes or conditions understanding. So I, if I'm thinking about my discipline, I want to be thinking about it first of all in through the lens of my faith, the same way if I'm relating to other people, encountering other people, I want to do it, I don't always do it, but through the lens of my relationship to God, then that shapes the way I react to them. And it seems to me that's a good habit of mind or whatever, or soul, or that one should try to cultivate. So at the same time you're trying to learn to do your discipline well, you still always have in the back of your head, what's the relationship to my religious commitment? How does God fit in this picture? And is the picture changed if God if God is in my intellectual horizon? I doubt if other people, other people might have other ways to put it, and this isn't the only way to put it, but I doubt if they would greatly disagree with that. In the very back there, yeah.
You were saying that in your scholarship is good for not only being Christian, but rather asking for identity, like being an American man, or a black man. And what do you think, what extent should other aspects of identity be subdued or surrendered to better being Christian? Scholarship from a Christian perspective, and how does it look like?
Well, it can be subdued or they could be fused with be taking the best in some other part of one's heritage or social location and fusing it with Christianity, or it could be, or maybe simultaneously, could be using Christianity to critique some other dimension of one's background. Yeah, it just depends what the background would be, I guess. But it's people talk about appropriating the spoils of Egypt. I mean, you can find from all sorts of traditions really really good things, even though the traditions might not be themselves all that they ought to be. Yeah.
Yeah. How would you respond to the charge that Christian scholarship or promoting Christian scholarship creates something of a ghettoizing effect for the community of scholars who consider themselves to be Christians, such that they might be anesthetizing those around them to their ability to hear what they might say about the truth? The capital T, because it's just a perspectival approach as opposed to a sort of a thoroughly, I don't quite know, integrated approach.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. At last, whether there's a real distinction between being perspectival and being integrated, but do you mean sort of socially that Christians tend to have their own subcommunities and universities, and that tends to sort of ghettoize it?
Well, earlier in the conference, one of the speakers was suggesting that the idea of saying I'm a Christian scholar and my perspective is valid in the same way that any other type of perspectives would be valid brings along with it anesthetization of the scholar who might all be, the non-Christian scholar who might hear Christian truth if it wasn't preceded by this is Christian scholarship.
That's along the line I was trying to say. Why I'm the term makes a lot of people uncomfortable, and I didn't talk about this, but one issue that one might talk about is to what extent should you be identifying it as in the particular Christian tradition that you're working in, or to some extent, you might be simply presenting it as, here's some really good arguments why people might think about things this way, and you might know that if you say this is coming out of my religious heritage, that will turn people off. But if you just make, it's a matter of diplomacy. To some extent, and personal relationships to some extent, but as I said, the strongest argument is for easiest argument to make is for religious beliefs as background or control beliefs, and they don't, it just depends on your setting where how explicit you might need to make that. Yeah.
In your Washington and Delaware example, I think you pointed out that your perspective is very metaphysical and that there's really no issue with the day when Washington crossed the Delaware. And as a historian, I think that's a very justifiable perspective. I was wondering if you have a perspective on the outrageous idea of Christian scholarship in fields where the integration of Christian faith and scholarship might lead to different physical perspectives, not just metaphysical.
For what are you thinking of?
What do you think?
Example.
Does a Christian in biology or cosmology attempt to integrate their beliefs about their faith into places where they might contradict scientific paradigm.
But you mean like in biological evolution?
I was trying to be non-inflammatory. Yeah.
Well, it should make a difference in how you view the questions involved. I mean, if you adopt a purely naturalist perspective, then you're pretty much forced to say that the best natural explanation is the best explanation there is. On the other hand, if you believe in God, the best natural explanation might not be the entire explanation, and how that impacts your science. There might be differences on, but it certainly does make a difference in your own perspective of, and this is, I think, an important thing in a lot of disciplines, sort of how seriously do you take your discipline? One of the peculiarities about the academic world is it's divided into all these disciplines and sub-disciplines, all of whom think that their way of looking at things is the most important way of looking at things in the world, and a very difficult time seeing things any other way. Christian perspective might help you just see, you know, my discipline doesn't really explain, you know, everything. And it's a good way to avoid a kind of a reductionist, and I think scientific naturalism is the most pervasive reductionism around.
Yeah. I hope I'm not repeating your question. I had to step out, but you mentioned in your lecture the goal of doing your research in your field really well. Mm-hmm. I want to ask, what Willard challenged us to do yesterday was to seriously challenge what that means and from where we get the standard of what really well means. I want to ask you, where do you get your standing? What does really well mean?
Well, as I said, there are multiple things going on when you do scholarship. So, if I'm writing history, I want to do my research very accurately, and I want to present a narrative that will be engaging to people and do that really well. But and I do that more or less the same way that anybody might. But if I choose to write about Jonathan Edwards and do that with respect to Jonathan Edwards, that changes the dimension, because I mean the subject that I've chosen and the questions I'm asking about the subject are permeated by my religious perspective. So there are some what I'm calling sort of craft dimensions of what I'm doing that I just want to do the craft really well, just as a visual artist would, you know, he just wants to do the art well, but then you might have some religious perspective that's... What's that? Well, they're not the property of they're not the property of the secular. I mean, it's not a secular thing to write well or to make a good film or paint a beautiful picture, something like that. So I'm saying you need to, if you're going to be a great musician, you need to. You can't have a tin ear, and so I mean but then you want to be have a Christian dimension to it. Well, that's going to be shaped by something else. Yeah.
I'm really intrigued by your third point about using some identifiers about the Christian tradition that you come out of, and I like that idea. I guess I'm struck by how much those identifiers, whether it's Protestant, Calvinist, or in my case, Baptist, need so many qualifiers in a way. Because when you come out of tradition, if you've done your work and you study it, you become critical of various angles of it, and then God doesn't really care about those labels. So that's what I think I struggle
with. Well, that, and that is a struggle, I think, in a lot of American traditions. It's well, they're, I mean, as you allude to, they're changing all the time, and also, Mark Knoll has written about, you know, the scandal of the evangelical mind. The first sentence says the scandal of the evangelical mind is there is no evangelical mind. That there's this kind of anti-intellectualism, and that's quite pervasive, and it's sort of often difficult for people in universities, you know, sort of to go to relate to their home churches. And the like. So there's all kinds of problems like that, and sometimes one has to find resources, borrow resources from other Christian traditions, and I think that's good that we have such diversity and we can be borrowing from each other, and there's some traditions, I mean, I think Reformed people are pretty good at intellectual things, but they're terrible at evangelism, and there's all kinds of things that they're really weak at, or I mean they try, but you can borrow from the strengths of various traditions, and you can find some really good things in some traditions without needing to buy into everything in them. There's a book I like by Richard Lovelace called The Dynamics of Spiritual Life. It is a wonderful book, basically saying that what we consider the heresies in Christian traditions are all taking some good insight and going too far with it. And I think it's a good reminder that you can learn even from traditions that may be, you know, gone too far in some direction. There's some something good there too.
One last question.
I guess you first.
Would you recommend an essay or a book or something that would lay out a kind of a reform perspective on common grace that helps kind of shape your intellectual foundation for sharing with, you know, our common human heritage and how that can help?
There's a very nice book by my friend Richard Mao, president of Fuller Seminary, on common grace. Written a couple years ago. Oh, he shines in all its fair, and that's really a good place to start. And he refers to a lot of other things. Yeah, it's on the book table.
I really like your idea of having our Christian identity, being forthright about the fact that our Christian identity influences the way we're writing about history, for example. But when we're talking about what tradition someone comes from, I think that we always run into that problem of we all have come into this tradition because all these people have converted into this tradition that someone else made. And therefore, to what extent is our Christianity, you know, ours, if we define our Christianity by a tradition that has already been there for 200 years before we came into it?
Well, yeah, but Christianity is, being a Christian is part of becoming part of a tradition going back, you know, to the, you know, the Old Testament and New Testament, and, you know, we're part of that, and then it has many branches, but we're defined by, you know, this is a major shaper of our identity, and that we're not shaping our identity, we're all by ourselves, but we're standing in a long tradition of faith that changes and has many variations, but I think that's a good thing to see yourself as rooted in something larger than just what's going on today or your own biases or whatever.